coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's new Teacher of the Year is a special education teacher at Brandywine High School.
I wish that people would look more at the students who need the support but don't look like they need the support. And we need funding for those kids.
We spend some time this week with State Teacher of the Year, Joshua Tabron. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have an update on the redevelopment efforts in Claymont. Plus, Arts Playlist highlights a new exhibition at the Delaware Art Museum. And Enlighten Me looks at the disproportionate impact of natural disasters, like last month's flooding in Wilmington. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The pandemic has not only slowed some development projects down, it's also changed the nature of some projects. One example is the long-planned First State Crossing project and others meant to completely transform large portions of the Claymont area. Contributor Larry Nightingale takes a closer look at where these efforts stand and how they're evolving in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to walk us through what he learned.
So your piece focuses largely on two projects in and around Claymont. Let's start with the bigger one, First State Crossing. This has been kicking around for a few years now. Looking to develop the former steel plant, which went by many names over the years. What was the original plan here when this all first started?
First State Crossing is really a massive undertaking. We're talking about redeveloping 425 acres in the northern part of Claymont, stretching from Interstate 95 on the west all the way over to the Delaware River. The commercial development company, which is based in St. Louis, bought the former steel mill property more than 6 years ago. In late 2019, CDC unveiled a comprehensive redevelopment plan, one that included office buildings, residential, retail, and light residential uses. Now, when CDC announced the plan, its top priority was to put up two office buildings and a parking garage near the new Claymont train station, which is now under construction. Next would come a mixed-use package, a combination of offices, retail, and apartments, followed by a huge residential project, more than 900 apartments and townhouses situated between the railroad tracks and the Delaware River. So now all three of these pieces would be located on the east side of the Philadelphia Pike, taking up maybe a little bit less than one half of the overall redevelopment area.
But that original vision, as you're reporting, is changing, pivoting to more residential in emphasis. How big is this change, and why is it morphing now?
Well, you know, the change isn't so much the vision that CDC has, but rather it's the market that has changed. And some of that, of course, is related to the pandemic. When COVID-19 struck early last year, CDC had not yet identified a tenant for the planned office buildings. Then, as the pandemic intensified, more people started working from home, prompting businesses to reassess their need for office space. So, as the office market declined, the housing market boomed. Therefore, last month, CDC filed a rezoning application with Newcastle County so it could build this planned riverfront townhouse and apartment community. Meanwhile, the planned office buildings and the mixed-use project are pretty much on hold. CDC will move ahead on them eventually, but right now its top priority is to get the residential piece started while the residential market is hot. Even so, don't think that a whole new town is going to suddenly appear along the river. The builders say that they can put up about 100 units a year, so we're looking at a 9 or 10 year project in terms of construction once the rezoning is approved.
And the addition of this more residential piece of the project is leading to some other changes. Can you talk to us a little bit about how this change in approach is leading to some actual changes in the plan?
Well, you know, since putting out this plan, CDC has developed a very strong working relationship with the Claymont Renaissance Development Corporation, which is a nonprofit that has been guiding Claymont's revitalization for nearly 20 years. So earlier this year, Claymont Renaissance reached out to a University of Delaware student group whose members have interest in environmental protection, landscaping, architecture, and design, and they asked them to develop a park or plan for a park on the banks of the Delaware River. The group produced a 60-page proposal that has already won the support of Claymont Renaissance, the developers, and several community organizations. In the past week, Brett Sadler, who heads Claymont Renaissance, has shared the plan with Governor Carney, with County Executive Matt Meyer, and with other key officials. Key pieces of this proposal include a marina, a boat launch, walking trails, an amphitheater for musical and theatrical performances, and a sports area with basketball and tennis courts, a soccer field, and a disc golf course. Now, it's going to take some money to create the park, and that means that either the county or the state would have to buy in and take charge. Now, we do know that CDC, which owns the land, is very interested in donating the needed acreage to whichever government body is willing to take on the project. But as I said, the government, one of these government bodies is going to have to buy in and say that they want to go ahead and do it in order for it to happen.
The new Claymont train station has also been long part of this vision. Can you update us on where that stands? Driving by it, it looks like something is happening, right?
Well, yeah. If you drive up Philadelphia Pike through Claymont, heading towards Pennsylvania, and look over towards the river, you're going to see some new brick buildings under construction. And those buildings are the new train station and the associated parking garage. Along Philadelphia Pike itself, construction crews are working towards building this new road, the Transit Center Boulevard, that will connect the Pike with the train station. And that project also includes a new traffic signal, and the stanchions for the light are up now, and a widened intersection that leads from Philadelphia Pike onto the new road. Now, that new train station, with all of its related improvements, is a $75 million project. There have been some delays in planning and in construction. There were some stormwater management issues and a few other things, and there's a lot of coordination with Amtrak that's also been involved that has slowed the progress. But right now, the current target date for the station opening will be in the summer of 2023.
And just to give people a little bit of perspective, it is north of where the current Claymont train station resides.
Yes, I think it's about a half a mile or so north, and it's located on a section where the track is straight. If you're familiar with the current Claymont station, the way that one was built, it's built on a section where the track is slightly curved, and it's not the ideal location. The new station is going to be on straight track, and there's going to be a lot more parking there.
What else do we know about this project's direction? That is the first state crossing project, and what is kind of the timeline for this moving forward?
Well, as I said, it's now the residential first, and then those two other pieces on the east side of Philadelphia Pike, the couple of office buildings near the train station and the mixed-use residential just to the north of that. Now, there's no timeline yet for developing the acreage on the west side of Philadelphia Pike, but the plans include more offices, more retail, and light industrial uses. In fact, Steve Collins from CDC says that they're talking about 1 million square feet of office space overall when everything at First State Crossing is built out, if they're able to go according to plan. Anyhow, the light industrial that they're talking about most likely translates to what's called these days a logistics center. In other words, a warehouse for e-commerce business. And that's a use that's becoming increasingly familiar to residents of Newcastle County and in other parts of Delaware as well.
Something we've reported on recently as well here on The Green. The other project is the redevelopment of the old Tri-State Mall. We also recently reported on that. Residents had hoped for more mixed use, shops, restaurants, recreational amenities, along with whatever else. But that does seem like it's pretty unlikely at this point, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. The company that bought the mall site earlier this year, KPR Properties, does have a lot of experience with retail operations and managing shopping centers. But, you know, this current decline in brick-and-mortar retail, which has been going on for several years, on top of the Tri-State Mall's lack of success in attracting and keeping tenants for the last decade or so, makes a change of direction a fairly easy call for the new owner. KPR, which has already torn down the old Levitt's Furniture building on the mall site, now plans to tear down the rest of the mall, and it's going to put up a 525,000 square foot e-commerce warehouse on this 40-acre site. Now, it's not eliminating the retail altogether. They're planning on putting about 15,000 square feet of retail space on the southeast corner of the property near Naaman's Road, not far from where that recently demolished Levitt's Furniture store used to be. And some of the businesses now operating on the mall's lower level may be able to move in there, but I'm not quite certain how that works out because it's not clear whether the new retail space is going to be built before the existing mall is totally torn down. It's not likely if the mall is torn down and these businesses are forced to close that they're going to be in a position to hang around in some fashion and then move into the new site. But we'll see.
So with that in mind, you know, what is the timeline on this project? I know people have been clamoring for something to be done just to get rid of kind of the eyesore of this property. Are they anywhere close to seeing the eyesore disappear no matter what goes there?
Well, the fact that KPR tore down the old Levitt's building, which had been in great disrepair, and did that rather quickly earlier this summer, is I guess a sign that they do want to move fast on this. The land already has proper zoning for a warehouse, so the approval process with the county should move relatively quickly. Now, assuming that there are no unexpected issues that develop in that process with the county, KPR's attorney anticipates approvals by late spring or early summer, and then maybe a year or so for construction. With that timeline, we're talking about the warehouse being up and running towards the end of 2023.
Let's take a larger look at what's going on here in Claymont and what may go on here in Claymont. This is taking some time, and it's evolving over time. Is what's happening here akin to what we saw over the years on the Wilmington Riverfront, with the end product perhaps being far removed from the original vision, but still deemed successful redevelopment of the area?
Well, you know, the reference to the Wilmington Riverfront is highly appropriate, and a couple of people that I talked to for this story made that point and made that comparison. The riverfront redevelopment in Wilmington has been going on for nearly 30 years. And if you've been around that long, you remember that the original concept was something resembling Baltimore's Inner Harbor. You know, and the early centerpieces, aside from Frawley Stadium, were an exhibition hall and a retail outlet mall. Now, they've been repurposed into a conference center and into office space. And the development on the east side of the Christina River on the Wilmington Riverfront is just starting now. So I think we can expect some of the same in Claymont. With First Aid Crossing, if the residential and office space on the east side of Philadelphia Pike are going to take as much as 10 years to build out, you know, it could easily take another decade for the west side to be developed, and it's not clear when that 10-year timeline might start to run. If you go back 10 years or so ago, the residential housing market was just starting to recover from the 2000-2008 recession. So if you look at that, it wouldn't be surprising to see at least one up and down cycle in the real estate residential market in the next decade or so. 10 years ago, e-commerce was in its infancy, and now it's hard to name a significant retailer that doesn't have an online platform. So 10 years from now, will there be the same demand for warehouses, you know, or will there be some other sort of next big thing in the commercial real estate market? The developers can't say for sure, but they do know that they have to be responsive to changes in the market if they're going to make any money as they move forward. Bottom line, there's a blueprint for change, for major change, at two of Claymont's best-known properties. The expectation is that the changes will be for the better. but there are no guarantees that the finished product, if there are any finished products, and you know, the Wilmington Riverfront, nobody's saying that that's finished or is going to be finished anytime soon. But anyhow, no guarantees that those finished products are going to match what has been drawn up in the plans that we are looking at today.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His piece, Updating Redevelopment Efforts in Claymont, is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We meet Delaware's new Teacher of the Year next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware named its 2022 Teacher of the Year earlier this week. The honor goes to Joshua Tabron, a special education teacher at Brandywine High School in the Brandywine School District. Tabron, who holds education degrees from Delaware State University and Wilmington University, is co-teacher in English classes at Brandywine High with a primary focus on ninth grade special education students transitioning to high school. And I had a chance to catch up with Tabron in her classroom at Brandywine High earlier this week.
Take me back to earlier this week. You hear your name announced as a Teacher of the Year. What's going through your mind in that moment?
That there must be someone else who had the same name. Even though I know how hard I work, and I know that it was just... it was possible. I didn't think it was possible. And, you know, we've never really had events that recognize teachers. So you do all this work, and to be recognized is like a fantasy. You never think that's going to happen. So it was like an ultimate moment of fulfillment. Like, it was great. It was great. I think you saw the picture of my son's face. He was just as shocked as I was.
Yeah. So when you accepted the award, the other night, you talked a lot about inclusiveness, yes, about working together as vital parts of student success. What does that look like on a day-to-day basis here in Brandywine High School as you're teaching?
Well, I don't think that anyone can identify immediately any student who needs special services, but what it looks like is community wrapped around one child who needs additional support. So I think that's the best way to describe it. We know that there are children that need support, and then inclusion kind of allows two teachers in every room to make sure that every student is having their needs met. And it's a lot. It looks like a marathon because that's really what it is. When it's done effectively, everyone's hands-on.
So is the goal to try to make it as seamless as possible, as not noticeable as possible?
It's not necessarily the goal, but that's just what the function of it is. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of students who need a lot of help. And they may not have special needs, but they may just need extra support. And I think the comfort of having two teachers in the room and following this co-teaching model that we've been doing for years allows students to get their needs met on all levels.
How difficult was it to continue fostering that togetherness, that inclusion during the past year and a half during the pandemic? I imagine that that was not an easy task.
Well, Ms. Walker and I'm going to just say we were really lucky. We had an amazing group of children, and I think that the students that we taught last year were so awesome. Like, we would have complete technological fails. They were like our tech support, and they'd say, try this. But we'd never met them because they were home. So the year really started with kids coming up to you, like, hey, Ms. T, hey, Ms. Walker, and taking off your mask, and you're like, oh, my gosh, it's you from box number 3 up in the right corner. So I think that, interestingly enough, we were all so overwhelmed that we were way more supportive. The students were supportive of the teachers because they're just like, I know it's hard. And we were supportive of our students because we knew it was hard for them as well.
Having said that, how much ground is there to make up based on what you had to overcome the past 2 school years?
So in between the ground to make things up and the ground where we stand are a lot of assumptions. Mm-hmm. We're coming in with these assumptions that Of course students know how to do this. This is something that they learned early on. Of course you know how to do this. This is something that you learned before. Everyone knows how to behave. And these are things that we are telling ourselves, and then later we have to remind ourselves, this is part of it as well. This is part of it. These are the gaps. You know, these are the things that we're expecting everyone knew. But maybe that wasn't taught until June or March, and we never made it there. So there are gaps, not just academically, which is where we're really focusing. There's social gaps. Like, kids have to learn how to have relationships with each other, how to have relationships with their teachers. So in the beginning, the first couple weeks, we had to focus on really closing the social gaps so that we could kind of create an environment where the learning could take place. And I think they've been pretty okay with catching up. Students, I hate to use the term, are resilient, but for the most part, when they're supported, they're open to learning.
And I imagine, particularly for those who are making the transition from middle school to high school, that's perhaps an even bigger issue and a bigger hill to climb.
Absolutely. I guess the analogy we've been using is they haven't had normal school since about the sixth grade. So we have a bunch of kids coming in who, one, can't find things, two, are going through hormones, three, are seeing their friends in person for the first time. So a lot of it is building in breaks where we can socialize, building in opportunities where we can be human, and then getting back to the work. But we have to include those breaks, otherwise it just explodes.
So being Teacher of the Year is an opportunity to have a platform to talk about education and education issues. And I imagine as a special education teacher, that's something you're going to want to focus on. Are there specific things about the state of special education in Delaware that you think people need to understand better, or issues that you feel people need to understand need to be addressed?
Absolutely. I guess the best way I could say this is the face of special education isn't always what we think it is. Mm-hmm. You know, we picture beyond cognitive disabilities, we picture physical disabilities, but we never really can see a cognitive disability. So sometimes when these things are masked behind behaviors because students don't feel confident, we forget that we still have to provide that support, and that these behaviors or these other things that we see are because we have a disability that we're trying to hide. And I wish that people would look more at the students who need the support but don't look like they need the support. And we need funding for those kids. We need funding, we need supports where we're providing whatever, the fidget, the technology. They deserve to have books that are adapted to their level. They deserve a lot of things that we don't necessarily look at because we're always looking at the kids who are the most neediest or the kids who are the most visibly neediest or the kids who are way at the top, and we know we want to continue to get them to the top. So those kids that fall right in the middle or below, those are the ones who are missed, and those are the ones that I hope I can advocate for as much as I'm able to.
So was there a teacher that inspired you or someone who inspired you to pursue teaching, specifically special education teaching?
Specifically special education, I don't know, because my high school was so different. Mm-hmm. Everyone was included except when they weren't. So you didn't know if students were receiving supports. Right. I think it would have been awesome to have two teachers in the classroom. When I think about teachers who inspired me, I think about my high school English teacher. Carmen Mason was her name, and she was insane. And she worked with a bunch of children, and she would see us in the supermarket and quiz us on how to spell miscellaneous and have us recite, you know, Macbeth, Act 5, Scene 5. You know it? You know it? You have bonus points? She would stop you on the street. And it was something about the building of those relationships. And just an appreciation for literature. She's the first person who introduced me to Toni Morrison, to Maya Angelou, and I was just like, oh, I would love to be able to bring this world to my kids. And so that's, I think, why I work primarily with English.
And now on the other end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. what advice would you give to a young person who's interested in getting into teaching, and specifically special education teaching?
Please come. We need change makers. We need people who are really invested in children and who understand that kids are not perfect. This is not a place of perfection. It's a place of progress. And I think that everyone who considers it can be a teacher. The kids in school, this is going to sound strange, but the kids in school who maybe did not fit, who did not maybe make every varsity team or the debate team or any of those things, and they felt awkward, they make the best teachers because they know what those kids need. So I invite everyone who can to come on and teach.
So I have to ask you, you're getting about $10,000 in grants to spend. Have you thought initially about what you want to spend that money on?
So I met with my department. We had our monthly department meeting yesterday, and I said to them, you know, we can get a smart board on wheels and move it around when we need it, or we can think about long-term, what are our students going to need? So what do you think would help you? Do we need to create maybe an internal award system? Do we want to do something where we have fidgets or a comfortable place when kids need a timeout space, or something that we can do that's going to help all of our students? And we're still thinking about it, but whatever it is, it's going to be for the community.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Thanks to Delaware Teacher of the Year, Joshua Tabron from Brandywine High School, for her time on The Green this week. And next up on The Green, Arts Playlist, and more on a new exhibition at the Delaware Art Museum that delves into works of medieval fantasy. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A new exhibition at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington traces medieval fantasy themes through American illustrator Howard Pyle and young adult literature. Fantasy and the Medieval Past was conceived by Emily Chartrand, a University of Delaware instructor and lecturer at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, PA. In this week's Arts Playlist, Chartrand joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to talk about this exhibition and how America's concept of medieval fantasy has changed over the last century.
How did you become involved with this exhibition, first off?
Well, so when I was finishing my PhD at the University of Delaware, the last 2 years I received a fellowship, the Lynn Herrick Sharp Curatorial Fellowship. And as part of that fellowship, I was asked to come up with an exhibition that involved, you know, some aspect of the permanent collection, but I was also welcome to kind of go beyond that. And so this exhibit is really, you know, it was something that I came up with and I worked on for the 2 years while I was at the Delaware Art Museum.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how long it took you. So the exhibition is called Fantasy and the Medieval Past. Neither one of those things I know anything about, so you're going to tell my listeners what this exhibition, what they can expect should they go to see it.
Well, so people might know that the Delaware Art Museum began as part of a collection by the artist Howard Pyle, who among you know, other things, his main goal or his main body of work as an artist was as an illustrator during the golden age of illustration in the late 19th into the early 20th century. And one of his big projects was he rewrote his own version of the King Arthur fantasy, and he illustrated it. And so he really wrote this as a sort of young adult book, like a book that, you know, parents might read with their kids. It kind of spanned that children to adult age range, you know, before we really had that category, right, of young adult books. And of course, the Arthurian romances are looking back at this medieval world from a fantasy perspective, right? You know, it's not a true story. And that was very popular in the late 19th century in both America and in Great Britain. So this exhibition is looking at some of these works from Pyle's collection that are in the Delaware Art Museum. And it is looking at them in conversation with contemporary illustrators who are illustrating young adult fantasy books that are also responding to this same medieval past. because the medieval kind of became popular again in the last 10 years or so. Think of things like Game of Thrones, right?
I've never seen one episode, but go ahead.
Well, so we continue in the United States to have this fascination with the medieval world played out through the fantasy. And the reason I became really interested in this is because my PhD is actually in medieval art. So I was curious to see how these American artists that are, you know, modern and contemporary were responding to an imagined medieval world, and also how our views of the medieval have changed in the last century. You know, Howard Pyle's view of the medieval that he plays out in his King Arthur illustrations, it's very white, it's very Eurocentric, because this is the view that people had of the medieval in the 19th century, and that's really changing now. These new artists, for example, Leo and Diane Dillon, they're one of the artists, they're an artist pair, a married couple. And they illustrated a book about Mansa Musa, who is a 13th century king of Mali. He was really famous for going on a journey, a Hajj, he was Muslim, across Africa to Saudi Arabia and to Mecca, of course. And he was really wealthy, and he sort of, as he was going on this journey, he flooded all of North Africa with all of this gold and wealth. And he was actually a real, very famous king in the medieval period. And so stories like his are beginning to be illustrated and looked back on in these kind of fantasy medieval books. It's quite fascinating.
Would you say, Emily, that this exhibition called Fantasy in the Medieval Past caters to a certain audience?
Yeah, I would certainly say it caters to a similar audience that a young adult novel might. It's certainly it's an exhibition that adults could very much enjoy, but it's also an exhibition that I think, you know, maybe not very young kids, but middle school and older kids would definitely be really fascinated by. It's books that some of, in cases they might be familiar with, some of the works of art by the artist Tony Dieter Lizzi. He co-wrote and illustrated the Spiderwick Chronicles, which are a very popular book series for kind of late elementary, early middle school ages. The exhibition, it looks at a bunch of different themes, but one of the themes is creatures. So these sort of fantasy creatures that we see cropping up in medieval-inspired fantasy worlds. So there's kind of fun, silly aspects like that, but also some more serious aspects looking at how we view knighthood and kingship and in terms of race and in terms of gender. You'll see a lot of representations of women as warriors, things like that as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, you had mentioned earlier in this interview about contemporary fantasy often representing female characters. Is that important in today's society?
Yeah, I would certainly say that the fantasy genre has often, you know, if you think of things like Lord of the Rings, for example, which is a great book series, but there's not a lot of, you know, certainly strong female characters. They're very few and far between. And that's certainly something that's been a big change in the last century, I would say. These contemporary works, I would say specifically some of the artwork done by Jan Schoenherr. He illustrated portions of a series by the author Kristen Cashore, and each of Kristen Cashore's books follow these very strong female characters, sort of as coming-of-age stories of these female characters who have a lot of power in the world that they're living in. And often are acting as warriors or leaders. And I think that's an important thing for young readers to see, right? For women to see themselves represented in these books, and people of color to see themselves represented as well.
So how many works of art and books are included in fantasy and the medieval past?
There's between 20 and 30 works of art that range from paintings to pen and ink drawings, so both in color and in black and white. And then we have three full cases of books, so I think 6 to 8 books as well. So it's quite interesting. You can see, you know, it is an illustration show, right? All of these works of art were made to be put inside of books. And so you can see them kind of large on the walls as, you know, framed as works of art. And then you can also see the books that they came from and see them in the kind of the situation they were made for. And then the Delaware Art Museum also has a lot of the books from the collection on sale in the museum store as well.
And you are going to be leading a special exhibition gallery talk on October the 16th. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I will be leading two different gallery talks, actually. There's one that's going to be at 11:30 a.m. and one at 1 p.m. And you just have to go to the website delart.org to pre-register for those. And I will be taking small groups through the collection, through the exhibit, and probably standing and focusing on a couple works of art from the exhibit, and really, you know, taking a long look at them. It'll be really interactive type of tour where I really am curious to hear the audiences. I'm curious to hear the audience's responses to the works, you know, how they see the different works that are in conversation together. And then, of course, I'll be providing some of the background detail and information for everyone as well.
Emily, what do you want people who visit the art museum and go through this exhibit, what do you want them to walk away thinking or feeling or talking about?
Well, I really want them to understand that, you know, of course, with any fantasy genre that looks at the past, it's always, you know, our current moment reflecting on that past, right? So I'm not saying that everything happening in this exhibit is a perfect representation of the actual medieval world, right? This is a fantasy exhibit. But what you can really tell in seeing these comparisons between works of art from, you know, a century ago and ones made in the last 10 years is just how much our concept of the medieval past has changed and the way our concept has changed to view it a little bit more accurately, honestly, because the medieval world, it wasn't a monolith. It wasn't a place where there was only one race, only one religion, only one type of thinking. It really was very global and very multicultural. And so I think that contemporary artists are understanding that, and contemporary society is understanding that and reflecting back on that in these fantasy novels.
Thanks to University of Delaware instructor Emily Chartrand, the mind behind the Delaware Art Museum's Fantasy and the Medieval Past exhibition, for joining our Kelly Steele on this week's Arts Playlist. Fantasy and the Medieval Past runs through January 2nd. And stay with us. Enlighten Me looks at the disproportionate impact of natural disasters, like last month's flooding in Wilmington. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Poor neighborhoods are often hit harder by natural disasters and struggle more than wealthier ones to recover. For example, the historic flooding from the remnants of Hurricane Ida last month devastated a low-income neighborhood in Wilmington. So as climate change drives more extreme weather, should the first state look at preparedness through an environmental justice lens? In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt explores this question with Victor Perez, an associate professor in the University of Delaware's Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice.
From an environmental justice standpoint, what are some of the issues that you tend to watch out for in the aftermath of a disaster like the flooding that we saw from Hurricane Ida in Wilmington?
Well, you want to start with this notion that disaster vulnerabilities exist first as issues of environmental justice. So you want to think about what are the social and built infrastructure vulnerabilities that create environmental injustices. Those also exacerbate the impacts of extreme storms like the one that we just saw. For example, if housing has issues, then the recovery process from, you know, even further damaged housing is going to be more difficult. If people are poor and lack resources or adequate access to their jobs and other things, those are going to be exacerbated by these kinds of events. Not only do they create a day-to-day experience that is more challenging, but these disaster events are going to exacerbate that.
So with all of that in mind, do you think that the city and state are doing enough to ensure that residents of Wilmington who were impacted by the flooding can recover?
Well, I don't know a whole lot about specifically what the efforts have been. From what I've read, my understanding is that the communications about what to do, where to go, or how to access resources were confusing or not readily available. I do think that ultimately the emergency declaration and the evacuation to get people out was successful in that there were no deaths or injuries, but the lack of a robust evacuation plan that could have been implemented it wasn't there. And so there's a lesson to be learned, and there's a real need for that. Now, that said, this storm was also historic in a lot of ways. But I do think that if these storms are becoming more frequent and the flooding is becoming more frequent and as bad as it is, this is absolutely high time to get a good sense of how to better prepare for this.
So we know that climate change makes heavy rains more frequent, and that can lead to flash flooding like we saw from Hurricane Ida. If indeed this is becoming more of a frequent reality for the city of Wilmington, what does the city and the state need to be doing to prepare to keep residents safe in the future and try to prevent material losses for them as well?
Well, you know, one of the main approaches, you can think about this in if you want to really sort of simplify it, you can think about it one of two ways. You either structurally mitigate, which is, you know, literally somehow recreating the built infrastructure to handle floodwaters. And in scenarios such as sea level rise and other things, there are a variety of ways to do that. In South Wilmington, a prominent example is, as of yet complete, if I understand it correctly, but a prominent example is the revitalized wetland that will hold stormwaters. The modeling for that, holding stormwaters and really alleviating some of the significant historical problems that Southbridge has had is very impressive. Now, you also have to keep in mind that structural mitigation is an opportunity to undo the inequalities that helped to create the vulnerable communities where environmental and disaster vulnerabilities exist that we saw unfold recently. What we shouldn't be doing is structurally mitigating in the future that will recreate inequalities either through displacement, what people call resilience gentrification. The other option is something like managed retreat. I mean, a basic question that we need to ask is, in communities that already face water issues, continue to face water issues, and as you mentioned, if these water issues are going to get worse in the future, when does it make sense to, and what does that even mean to really, you know, start a process of managed retreat? People are going to lose historical roots, culture, attachment to place, et cetera. At its core, managed retreat is meant to really be a cost-effective way of dealing with future climate change impact issues, reducing, coming from the work of A.R. Siders, a colleague of mine at the Disaster Research Center, quote, reducing the cost of future emergency response. So, you know, at what point does it make sense to try and think seriously about something like that when we have these events happening more frequently and with more severity in these communities?
Are there any examples of this kind of planning that has gone well. Some planning that you were mentioning there, you know, we don't want to recreate the inequities that are present in the current systems. Do you know of any examples where the community was involved in designing a solution to flood risk and things basically turned out better on the other side?
Oh, gosh. there were a couple of communities in Brooklyn that were slated for, you know, greening. And the community got involved very early because they were worried about displacement, got involved very early. And there were, I think, you know, some reasonable outcomes on both ends in terms of revitalization, greening, but also really giving back to the community in which those things were happening. Most of the examples of at least greening as an aspect of structural mitigation in urban, you know, coastal areas tend to suggest that the communities don't fare as well as you would think. The communities don't benefit necessarily from the greening in a long-term sense because of displacement issues. But if you can mitigate floodwaters relatively quickly, of course people don't want, you know, the community to flood anymore. They don't want basements, you know, with flood water and losing washers and dryers and so on. Of course, they don't want that anymore. But it has to be tailored in a way so that affordable housing, rent control, community land trusts, and a variety of other factors came into play very early on through community involvement to prevent the negative aspects of a creation of different types of inequalities. So no longer are people dealing necessarily with inequality that created flood situations and environmental injustices. Now they're dealing with social inequalities created by the solution.
That paints kind of a grim picture. Is there any, I guess, suggestions you can give for the city of Wilmington or the state as they're starting to potentially think about these things that could try to avoid these negative externalities to the solutions?
So one thing that I would argue, you know, is necessary is much deeper communication with the communities that are being affected. I know that there is outreach and I know that there are presentations from time to time, these sorts of things, but it just isn't adequate. There needs to be robust, transparent community involvement from the very beginning. We can't be talking about affordable housing, for example, in structural mitigation, you know, after the newspaper article comes out about the development. You should have been talking about it years ago. So that said, there are some principles for just disaster recovery that I think are helpful in a general sense for any sort of community that has both social and environmental vulnerabilities that can be exacerbated in these disaster scenarios. And basically, it's government assistance has to be timely. It has to be easy to understand and accessible. Now, if I'm reading some of the news articles recently correctly, these things didn't happen in the recent event. The second principle is temporary housing needs to be made available for everyone that allows you to reconnect to family or and pets and whatever the important networks are that you have so that your social capital isn't torn apart. The third of these principles is that anybody displaced needs to be able to access needed resources and rebuilding in a way that also allows for getting back to your jobs. And if your jobs were in the community, some sort of, you know, wage replacement or some sort of way to work for wages. And then involvement, having a say in policy decisions that are transparent, using these disaster events as ways to not necessarily, you know, provide a clean slate, but to learn from the past in creating the vulnerabilities that they did and undo them in the rebuilding process. And so rebuild in ways that create equity for the future and create, you know, a just recovery for the future.
Victor Perez of the University of Delaware's Disaster Research Center, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Thanks to the University of Delaware's Victor Perez and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nangest, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele, and our show producer Rebecca Baer. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.